This is Just the Right Book, and I'm Roxanne Cody of R.J. Julia Booksellers. Each week, I hope to bring to you the stories behind the books, talking with some of the very best contemporary nonfiction authors, books that are timeless and charming, provocative, and of the moment. The conversations you want to hear about the books you need to read. How many times have any of us been in conversation with other women, lamenting not being good enough, smart enough, productive enough, thin enough, and every other enough? My guess is zillions. Do men share these laments? And is the source of these failures fundamental? Do they in fact go back to the codification of the seven deadly sins by the Christian church in the fourth century? These questions and concepts are intriguingly explored by Elise Lunin in her new book, On Our Best Behavior, The Seven Deadly Sins and the Price Women Pay to Be Good. Elise brings a wealth of experience and research and intelligence to the topic, having been an editor at Lucky Magazine and as chief content officer of Goop. She led the brand's content strategy and programming, including interviewing hundreds of the most prominent thought leaders, including the likes of Ibram Kendi, Brian Stevenson, Nicholas Kristof, Terry Tempest Williams, Adam Grant, and Malcolm Gladwell, to name a few. Her new book contains enough topics for us to spend days in conversation, so I'm excited to just get started. Elise, welcome to Just the Right Book.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
So you open your book with a quote from the visionary anthropologist Ashley Montague. And the quote is, "The forms of behavior that characterize us as human beings are determined by the socialization process we undergo, the cultural conditioning in which we are molded, the customs by which we are all made. And there's the rub. For we are the most educable of all creatures on this earth. Everything we come to be, to know, and to do as human beings, we have to learn from other human beings." When you first read this, just what did it provoke in you?
It inspires, even to this day, a sinking feeling. Oh, right. And Ashley Montague, was the one who argued that we should really be called gatherer-hunters, not hunter-gatherers. And he wrote this book in the 50s called The Natural Superiority of Women, which he sort of argues along like biological fact, our ability to endure, outlive men, the fact that we've been outperforming boys in school for a century. But anyway, he talks about humans as having first nature and second nature. And first nature is who we really are. And then second nature is the stories we tell about who we are. And so for me, it became about like this impossible to pull apart, right? Who we are without culture, we'll never know, right? It's sort of an Ouroboros eating its tail.
Right.
Does nature inform culture? Does culture inform nature? Are both happening simultaneously? And so that's what I really wanted to understand in this book. Where are these ideas of, you know, the book's thesis is that women are conditioned and programmed for goodness, quote unquote goodness, an externally adjudicated idea. It's not really about men, but men are conditioned and programmed for power. And that threats to the goodness of women, threats to our reputation, when we say a woman's bad, unkind, uncaring, a bad mother, these are the worst things that you can say about a woman. Meanwhile, a man can be convicted of a crime, and as long as he's still powerful, we venerate him.
Mm.
Reputational damage doesn't hit men in the same way. So going back to Ashley Montague, I wanted to understand where these cultural ideas of goodness came from, where it started, and how much of who we are we've taken as nature when really it's culture, and how much of what it is to be a woman is what it is to be a woman versus what we're told a woman or specifically a good woman is.
So I was fascinated because somehow when we think about these issues, which I think as women, we inevitably think about, I wouldn't have thought it went as far back as your research would indicate. And then it was fascinating that the construct that you use were the seven deadly sins. So, you know, I don't know whether this is that I wasn't paying attention, but it never dawned on me that the seven deadly sins weren't biblical.
Yeah.
In origin, that they were biblical. So share with us, like, what are the source of these seven deadly sins?
Yeah. And you probably haven't thought much about them. I mean, I didn't grow up in a religious household. So for me, when I first sort of was looking for this idea of goodness and I came to the sins and then they read like a punch card of goodness for women, I was like, oh my God. And then where did they come from? And where are they in the Bible? They weren't in the Bible. They came out of the Egyptian desert in the 4th century, almost simultaneous to when the New Testament was codified, within a couple of decades. They were written down by this monk named Evagrius Ponticus, who's also credited as an early father of the Enneagram, for any listeners who are Enneagram people. Mm. And he wrote them down as these 8 demonic thoughts, demon meaning distraction, things that would pull you out of prayer. And then he created this little spell book of pieces of scripture to use to sort of put yourself back in relationship with God in the way that an ascetic monk might want to be. So they traveled from there around the desert, passing from desert father to desert father. And then it wasn't until 590 that Pope Gregory I took this list, sadness. So the list is sloth, pride, envy, gluttony, greed, lust, and anger. And then the 8th thought was sadness. And sadness drops for some reason. And the 7 become the cardinal vices. And in the same homily, to back up for a second, you know, as we know, the New Testament is the 4 gospels. The rest of the gospels that were in existence were deemed heretical and cast out to be destroyed. We'll never know how many there were. We've discovered some in recent years, including the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Philip. So Mary Magdalene is referenced in the New Testament as it is today as the one from whom Jesus cast 7 demons. It's mentioned a few times. It's never stated what those are. Some theologians say maybe he was rebalancing her chakras or she'd be the most sanctified person in the Bible. But that's mentioned several times. So going back to 590, Pope Gregory in the same homily says that these are the cardinal vices, that these are the same vices that Jesus cast out of Mary, and that she is the same as the woman who anoints Jesus' feet with her hair, and that that woman is a penitent prostitute. And so in one fell swoop, they are assigned to Mary Magdalene, and she's turned into a whore, and she carried this reputation until like 1980, I think, or 90. She was no longer, like, they acknowledged that they made an error. And then in 2016, Pope Francis turned her into the apostle to the apostles. But that's where penitent prostitute Mary Magdalene comes from. And that's where women are assigned as the carriers of the 7 deadly sins.
Okay. So that was a lot of information. So here, which in the book, you spend a good amount of thoughtful time helping us put into place. So I want to take it apart. So we've got the 8 demons that were made up and then adopted as the 7 deadly sins.
Mm-hmm.
So one concept that you couldn't help but think about as you read the book is, okay, these are sins, and sins have an absoluteness that would apply to men and women.
Mm-hmm.
But is it fair to say that your contention is that given the way in which the Pope indoctrinated them, that they became more defining for women than they were for men?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. And I think that it's, you know, it's complex and layered. I think that's sort of one of the keys that I could find in the talent. This is the thing about culture, right? It's contagious and we pass it on. But this idea that this woman, who was maybe one of the most prominent and important people in the Bible, was base and full of the carrier of these sins. It's very similar to sort of Adam and Eve and the way that that story is told, that this
it was her fault.
Her fault. And therefore, it's not, I think so much of this isn't conscious. It's not like it's been passed down as like, but that this is the legacy. This is where these seeds were first planted in the culture. And then we look at where we are now, and this is how it continues to show up in our lives. And a lot of the book is about, it's not, you know, I grew up in a very progressive family. My parents did what they could in many ways to protect me from sort of this overriding, prevailing patriarchal culture. And I'm married to a feminist man, et cetera. But like, this stuff is so alive in me. I wasn't raised in religion. I didn't hear this routinely from a priest. But the book is about how we pass on these ideas. A good woman needs no rest, has no wants, is in service to other people's needs primarily, doesn't really have any appetites or desires, never gets upset. And, you know, we have this script, right? And then we pass it on to each other. And as we police it in ourselves, we police it in each other without really having any idea where it came from. And for me, a big revelation was seeing all the social science and recognizing the chasm between where the lack of equity in our culture and but not having any real men to play on whom to place the blame. And not saying that there aren't misogynists in our midst, and there can be misogynistic women, certainly. But I was like, I don't have a husband who's like, I expect five meals a day home cooked. I expect all the laundry to be done. I expect you to do all of these things. This isn't coming for me, at least in any of my personal relationships. And yet it is so strong and insistent, this internal cattle prod that I have to achieve and do and perform and ritually prove that I am good and a good mother and, you know, this breathlessness that I describe. It's in me.
So that I think, it certainly resonated with me, and for similar reasons. I did not grow up in a progressive household. I grew up in a religious Orthodox Jewish house, but I had a father who expected that I would go out and conquer the world and have a husband who, like your husband, is a feminist husband and never expected what might be called wifely duties. He didn't expect they were all going to come from me. Yet I share many of the things that you talk about in the book. So, and I don't, with the exception of like a couple of men that might be jerks, I don't hold men responsible for the problem. And so what I think your book made me think about is we have been so, for hundreds and hundreds of years, inculcated with what's almost unconscious. Mm-hmm. Not is almost unconscious.
It is.
It is unconscious that this is, in fact, you know, that it like pops up like bad bugs, you know, even though you think you personally and your family have exterminated them.
Yep.
You know, the book that Elaine Pagels came out with, maybe that was 10, 15 years ago.
Was it the one
on the Gnostic Gospels?
Yeah, the Gnostic Gospels, 1979.
Oh, God, it was that long ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, reading that, share with us just for a minute, because I found it so fascinating. How was the Gospel of Mary, which is one of the Gnostic Gospels, so vividly and markedly different from the Gospels that became part of the Bible?
Yeah. So the Gospel of Mary, and we have a couple versions of it, and I think they're both missing the same pages, but it is a very beautiful gospel, and Gnosticism is to know. And one of its distinguishing factors from sort of the new canon as we have it today is that it's all about this direct experiencing of God and this idea that it's all within us. It's all accessible to us. This isn't about any external priest, church, etc. This is about you know, goodness, you could say, and I write about good as this cultural ideal or value, but that I would argue that we're all inherently good. This isn't sort of a value that can be assigned. So the Gospel of Mary is her. So she is, and this is all in the New Testament, she's the one to whom, regardless of what you believe, that Jesus resurrects to. She's the one who goes back to the tomb. The three Marys are there with him after he's crucified. And then she returns, mistakes him for a gardener, calls him Rabboni. Of course, they're all Jews, falls at his feet, and he gives her this teaching. And that is what is in the Gospel of Mary. And then she goes back, which would have made her the first apostle, just for what it's worth. She goes back to the other apostles.
Say that again, Elise.
She would have been the first apostle. This would have been a female apostolic tradition, not male. So she goes back to the other apostles, tells them the teaching. Peter, who's total misogynist, is like, he would never have given this to you. You're a woman. Another one of the apostles is like, he likes her more than he likes all of us. She was his best student, effectively. There's a lot of suggestions in the Gnostic Gospels that maybe they had a like more than relationship, but I don't think that's the most interesting part. I think she really understood what he was trying to impart. So anyway, she comes back, tells him this teaching, which is about, he's explaining to her how he descended and encountered these powers or climates, they're translated in different ways, on his ascension back to God, which in some ways could be much broader, more interesting versions of the sins. And in this gospel, he's essentially saying, do not listen to any external lawmaker. What is adulterous is when you do things that are outside of your own nature. Essentially, like, your goodness is baked into who you are. Do not stray from that. And I am always in here in you. It's a very, very beautiful, very different gospel. And that's very much what distinguishes the Gnostic Gospels. They tend to be a lot more about this direct knowing.
Yeah. And you know, the way you wrote about it, I had read Elaine Pagel's book when it came out and was just mesmerized. I grew up in the Judaic tradition, not in the Christian tradition. But what I was really struck by was this kind of simple notion of the divine, this idea of there not being a gatekeeper for the divine. But as you just said, that the divine was within us. And that's just, you know, such a beautiful concept and reinforces this idea, you know, that you hear a lot about now of being accepted for who you are and you accepting who you really are. But this notion of categorizing it in a notion of the divine makes it more powerful. Because the other sounds new agey, like, you know, go you.
Yeah.
Right.
You do you. Yes, totally.
You do you.
Yeah.
But it just gives it a heft that I think gives us pause.
Yeah. No, I think that's beautifully stated. And so it's a very affirming gospel. And it's not easy. I think we all know that culture will intervene to distort us in all sorts of ways. And that our job is to really do you, right? To go. It is to, you know, we're all uniquely gifted and that's our job here is to bring that to bear with minimal distortion if possible. But that's a very tall order, particularly in our world.
You know, before we cover a few of the sins, because we have to cover a few of them, one of the things that you just reminded me of, and I'm going to probably butcher the nuance of it, but one of the philosophers that I greatly admire is Martin Buber. And one of his notions is that the Messiah will come when each of us have fulfilled our unique role. And the suggestion is that not everybody has to cure cancer, not everybody has to be the kindest person on the planet, that you can be what the world might call insignificant, but have a unique role.
Yeah.
And this is, now that I'm listening to you, it's closer to the Gospel of Mary.
Yeah. I love that.
I had never put that together.
Yeah. No, I think that that's very beautiful and very accurate to sort of what I think, yeah, this particular gospel says and seems to be sort of this, I think it's in Gospel of Thomas or Gospel of Philip, another where it's like, essentially need to bring out what's in you. Otherwise, if you do not bring it out, it will kill you. I should look up the exact phrasing, but it's essentially like you have to birth this true self.
Yeah.
And I love the idea that we're not evolving or we're not moving out of this until each of us, we help each of us get to that point of pure expression. And that, yes, we have, you called it insignificant, which I think is a really great way of thinking about it, because in this culture, which is oriented around power, goodness, et cetera, being in the world for men, being of service to the world for women, to quote Carol Gilligan, in terms of the maturation or how girls and boys are sort of taught or come to inhabit some sort of morality, what we prioritize, the way that we perceive success or value is so skewed, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you're not doing it on some sort of, if you're not Elon or Bezos, I mean, the people who we venerate, it's so skewed versus like who actually affects your life more acutely.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's also aligned with that notion that very few great men are good men. Mm-hmm. And that could apply to men or women. I don't think it's uniquely male or female, but the same thing that contributes to somebody's greatness probably means the counterweight is having to give something else up that might make them a good person.
Mm.
Right?
Yes. And I think that we're much more allowing of that trade-off in men to for a woman to do that seems sort of, again, it somehow goes against what we're told woman is at her nature, you know?
To that point, let's go to pride.
Yes.
So a number of years ago, I think in one of the first years I did this podcast, so which is about 5 or 6 years ago, I interviewed Sadie Doyle for her book, Trainwreck.
Yeah.
Which was the women we love to hate, mock, and fear. And, you know, the Amy Winehouses that we want to make them responsible for their fall. Their success was like more than we can bear.
Yeah.
And they, you know, with Schadenfreude on steroids.
Yes.
And you use what I think is such a perfect contrast about pride. And that is in the same Emmys or Oscars, let's say Oscars, because I think it was, we had Anne Hathaway and Jennifer Lawrence. And describe how we reacted to each of them and your thought as to why.
Yeah. So I opened the book talking about Anne Hathaway and what came to be the Hathaway haters. And by the time she was nominated and won for Les Miserables, she had been nominated before and the world had come to tire of her earnest and sort of devoted effort to her craft and what we perceived to be sort of this, like, I don't even know how to explain it. Just like she became a dumping ground for culture. And you'll remember when she co-hosted the Oscars with James Franco, who was completely high. And he was, you know, culturally, people were like, oh, he's so charming. She's so earnest and lame. Meanwhile, she's trying to sort of hold the whole show together right. While he's just a disaster. So she had come to be criticized for every single effort. And she holds her, you know, she says to her Oscar when she wins, oh, it came true. And she was just mocked and derided for this, this acknowledgement that she had a dream, she worked for it, and she got it. And she essentially went into hiding. She's still sort of like constantly asked about why people hate her so much. On the flip side, we have Jennifer Lawrence, who was nominated and I think won for Silver Linings Playbook, who was like bumbling, you know, tripping down the stairs, falling, self-effacing, just like already
playing the part. And had a princess. Didn't she have I could be piling on inaccurately, but didn't Jennifer Lawrence have a princess kind of dress and yes. Anne Hathaway had a sheath?
Yes, Anne Hathaway wore a sheath. And she had some sort of like cone boob situation going because she had found out the night before that someone was wearing the dress or something equivalent to the dress that she was planning. So she made a last minute choice. She was destroyed for this dress. And yes, Jennifer Lawrence, I think, was wearing sort of a princess gown, just seemed sort of like sweet, bumbling, self-effacing, minimizing. Don't look at me. I have no idea what I'm doing here. I have no idea how this happened. I do not think I'm all that. I do not think I'm grand. And this is in the same Oscars. And Jennifer Lawrence, I think, has since gone on to be sort of like destroyed too. We're seeing Lizzo right now. But there is this such an insistent playbook for highly visible women where they reach a certain mm-hmm. a certain moment of success or visibility in our culture and we turn on them and destroy them. It just happens over and over. We're just a graveyard of examples. Sometimes we like to sort of free Britney, watch them rise again, but we pretty much destroyed them. Sometimes they die, like Amy
We're
Winehouse.
Kidding. Yeah. We're kidding.
Yeah. Billie Holiday.
We're actually kidding.
Yes. So, and then women, you know, like me, like civilians can say, we can sort of celebrate, we can participate in you've mentioned Schadenfreude, the joy plus harm as we watch a woman be put back in her place, be brought back down to size. We get those feelings of like, oh, this is fun. But I don't think recognize that we're just watching a playbook for all women, for any woman who dares to have a dream for herself, dares to be celebrated for her talent. Like they will come. I actually think, I didn't write about this, but I was in watching Taylor Swift and the Eras Tour and then the Swifties, her army. I think that that is a very natural emergence of an acknowledgement that this is what happens and they will not let it happen. They are like out for blood if you dare go for Taylor.
Well, it'll be interesting, Elise, because I, like everybody else, have been reading about the tour and she's now exceeded $1 billion. That does she have the potential, she in the way she has managed to be both ambitious and kind and thoughtful to her fans, maybe suggest a pivot that these, you know, I was talking to a woman that I work with who has young girls, and they went to two concerts. And one of the things that my friend said was, she loved the message that the girls were taking on, that she felt like this was for their better, that they were thinking of Taylor Swift as in control of her life and singing what she wanted to sing and being honest. I mean, I've never been to a Taylor Swift concert. I don't even know, I shouldn't even admit this, that I would recognize the music. I have a son. But I do think you're bringing up an interesting point that she conceivably could become an icon for a different way of thinking about women who will be protected by her own people if anyone tries to bring her down.
Yeah, we'll see. I think that those Swifties are an essential mechanism of defense. And I think we'll see what happens. I hope so.
So let's take this issue of, let's stick with pride for a minute. We might not get to enough sins, which means we don't have to care about them. But one of the things that you say in the book is, under pride, is in all of my jobs, I've been thrilled to hide behind the brands and their famous founders, and I reveled in anonymity. Mm-hmm. Now you've written this book, only your name, Elise, is on this book. There's no, you're not the ghostwriter, you're not the co-writer. And you now have your own wonderful podcast, which I've been absorbing at a very fast pace, called Pulling the Thread. So what appealed to you about the anonymity, and why'd you decide to like reveal yourself, you know, now? Yeah. I think you started the podcast in 2021.
Yeah. I mean, I felt a lot of safety for all of these reasons and not being the one who was seen, but pushing ideas into the world or helping to sort of find other people to say them for me or to help more powerful people and women shape their own ideas, because I've ghostwritten 12 books as well. And yeah, I enjoyed a lot of safety. And in part, I think because inherently or without, before I wrote this book, I recognized this pattern and I recognized like, wow, that's a big price to pay. And so what happened is I started many years ago when I was at Goop, I started co-hosting the podcast. Prior to that, I don't think anyone would have known that I worked there. I kept a pretty low profile. And that was an amazing experience because one, I got, you know, to interview Bryan Stevenson or, you know, incredible people. Podcast hosting is really fun. And, but then I also was exposed to listeners and there was a lot of warmth, not entirely exclusively warmth, but I received a lot of women who were like, you sound like me. These are the questions I would like to ask. Like, I appreciate that you're brave and ask the questions and expose yourself as part of it. And so it became a very nice, warm way to enter the world. It's audio. You don't have to do your makeup.
I know.
It's amazing. And so
Excuse me, just as a quick thing, you know, it's funny that you say that because I used to do book reviews on TV, you know, on a local channel. Sometimes I did the Today Show or Good Morning America. And I you know, I would just fret over not what I had to say, but how I looked. And having done podcasting for 6 years, I think I mean, you know how I look, but that I, you know, I have to remember to comb my hair for a podcast.
Yeah, same. I put on some lipstick.
So did I. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, but it's, and there's something about audio where you're really, there's a resonance there that I think we're in such a visual culture that to sort of take all of that away is very appealing to me. Mm-hmm. So, but anyway, it's, I sort of got a taste and I loved podcasting and I obviously like writing books. I've done it many times, just not for myself. And when I decided to finally do this and I've been out sort of working for myself for 3 years now, and it's, I don't want to say that I think it's scary because I still have a certain veil. I mean, it's not like most people don't know what I look like. It's still small. It's still intimate. The people who listen to my podcast feel like they know me. But if my book grows, if my podcast grows, then I definitely, you know, those same anxieties are with me. And the only safety that I can offer, the only way that I feel like I can create security or shield is to just hew as close to who I say I am as possible. And then it's hard to sort of pick someone apart when I'm like, listen, all my laundry is out there. Like I am constantly working on myself and trying to interrogate how all of these cultural ideas live in me and are then projected by me onto other people. That I hope that, but you know, it'll happen. In success, like it'll happen. And that's unfortunate. And I hope that I have sort of the temerity to endure through what will probably feel like assault on quote unquote my goodness, you know, the whole like meta subject of the book.
Right. and we're going to come to that. I want to cover one more sin before we get to the broader notion that you just raised. So one of these things I read the other day on an Instagram that I always find funny, I forget what Instagram it is, had this quote, "My husband and I both have colds. I'm cleaning the kitchen and he's dying." So this goes under
sloth.
So you write that, don't you love that?
It's perfect. That is yeah. right. Or I'm like, I have a cold. And my husband's like, I have a cold.
No, but the idea that you're cleaning the kitchen and he's dying. I mean, how perfect is that? So you write under sloth that you're driven by an ever-present fear. If I don't do enough, I won't be enough. Effort is my best self-protection, my coping mechanism. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I could fall into that category. I know a lot of women whose identity is very tied to their being productive.
Yes.
You know, people who add something to a list that wasn't on it so they could check it. So what do you think is the source of that feeling?
Honestly, I think that as women, we're conditioned to believe that there's always sort of in this need to subjugate our wants to other people's needs, that there's always something to be done. There is no end to the doing in this pursuit of being a good mother, a good coworker, a good wife, whatever it is. There's this belief, I think, that we have that we'll cross some sort of finish line. And that's obviously a fallacy and a myth. Like the to-do list is never done, right? As much as I am that person you just described, I write down everything I did so I can cross it off and have some measure of my day. I think ultimately it hides for me at least, and I think for my own mother, who I write about a fair amount, this all of that chaos, all that bad feeling that I've suppressed and repressed. Busyness is the antidote. Busyness is the way that I don't have to feel my feelings. I don't have to think about them. I don't have to be present with myself. I can just go and do all of this stuff and show the world that I have value and that I'm a good person. Look at what I've managed to achieve today. And it's hard this because I am also rewarded for it endlessly.
Right.
As much as I'm like still driven by this, like there's still more that I can do. I shouldn't, you know, I have this invisible cattle prod at my butt all the time. My husband, you know, said to me that since we've been married, that I hadn't sat with him for more than 20 minutes and watched a TV show or a movie without getting up to do something, whether that's getting my computer, going to put some dishes in the dishwasher, starting some laundry. I have such an anxiety, right, about rest or not doing enough. And that was a big aha for me, unfortunately, was like, oh, actually, this isn't him. This is me. This is a self-propelled, busy doing machine that I like, let me off this ride. Let me off.
Yeah. So speaking of that, sort of stopping that noise, you have a beautiful paragraph towards the end of the book that I really want to spend these last 5 minutes we have exploring. So you say, with space, stillness, and sacred pause, I began to recognize how cultural distortions were showing up in my own life and my own body. I found the room to see the crevice between who I really was and how I had been performing myself in the outside world. I thought a lot about that breathless, overwhelmed girl inside me, suffocating from the strictures of a society that insisted I prove my good enoughness ritually. This book became the container in which I processed all the ways I'd been programmed by the cultural codes of virtue, by the ways I'd been convinced that if I was perfect in my behavior, I'd be lovable, safe, and accepted. So my question for you, Elise, is having recognized this, because you start the paragraph with the language I began to recognize, having recognized this, to what degree have you really been able to shift your gaze?
Yeah. So this isn't the sort of book that's like, here's the key and now everything is great. I can't make those promises. And I haven't achieved that in my own life. But I am now much more conscious of these voices that I thought were mine. And now I recognize are cultural voices, toxic cultural stories. I'm much better at recognizing when they are alive in me and when they are flagellating me. So this, like, I was so bad. I ate all that pub cheese last week. Now I need to be good. I just hear it now. And before, it was more running on a subconscious level in myself. And I was just reacting to it all the time. So that's been the first step for me. It doesn't make the discomfort go away. But now I can say, wait, this is, I need to understand and diagnose what this feeling is instead of suppressing and repressing it. The great thing I would offer, and this is only, we're just a few months into the book being out, you know, I wrote this by myself with my editor and my agent and felt like it would resonate, but didn't know. And now that it's alive in the world and I can talk about it with other women, some strangers, some friends, and watch them start processing it, I'm starting to see it speed up in myself and in the culture, that it becomes a framework where we can interrupt with each other and just be like, wait, stop. What did you just say? Like, let's like actually interrogate that and understand what that is. And that gives me a lot of hope because I think that it's really hard to change culture in a silo. I think we see this all over, you know, your family, my family, your parents can give you all sorts of ideas, but they can't protect you from the wider culture. But we can change the culture collectively. It just takes collective work.
Yeah. And the other question that it raises, and I know you don't want to give advice or suggest that you sort of arrived at nirvana. You're not exactly, you know, davening in a closet by yourself. You're out there working, being productive. You've got two kids. You're doing a weekly podcast. You wrote a book. So I get the idea that it's, and I respect that, that it's an ongoing process. But what advice do you have for others who, aside from reading your book and beginning to think about what's actually cultural, what is a way for women to start having these conversations with each other or themselves?
Yeah. So for me, the biggest, the gateway to the book, the most, I think, resonance in for women, for myself as well, is envy. And I wrote about that sin. I sort of came into the book through envy, through a conversation with Lori Gottlieb, who wrote, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone. She's a psychotherapist, years ago. Small aside in her book where she said, I always tell my clients to pay attention to their envy because it shows them what they want. And I asked her if it was gendered. And she said she didn't have the data, but she would expect that it is. And that women are much more self-conscious about feelings that we perceive as bad. And this really set me on a course because one, I was like, where is my envy? And then secondly, like, what do I want? I don't actually know. I have just been sort of doing my best in life, but I don't know how much of that has been sort of on auto drive versus me saying like, this is what I want and I'm moving into it. And then I took it a step further to say, okay, who am I actually envious of? And I'm not even conscious of the fact that I'm envious. And who am I deprecating around me by projecting these bad feelings? So who has something that I want or is doing something that I want, but I'm not conscious that it's actually envy that's activated in me. And instead I'm saying, I just don't like her, or who does she think she is? Or I really don't think that that book is that good, or whatever it is, these tormentors, these people who are full of information. That for me was like a really big place to start. That's why I ended up writing this book, because through that, I was like, oh, I know what I want. I want to write books under my own name. This is what I want to do in the world. And I need to actually take that information, recognize that these women who are doing what I want are not preventing me. They're not standing in my way. They are just pushing on a dream I have for myself. And I think if women can do that, it can be a great way to sort of back into oh, that's what I want. That's my gift. Going to our conversation about Mary Magdalene, that's what I'm supposed, that is my soul's call pushing me into my destiny.
Mm-hmm. I like that. I had interviewed Lori also, Lori Gottlieb, who I adored. And her book is called Maybe You Should Talk to Someone.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
Another book worth reading. But I like that as the thread to pull, as a way to begin thinking about it. That if envy is the source of your wants, pay attention and start with what you want.
Start with what you want. And that requires sort of understanding how you might be projecting that onto the person who has what you want. I think it might be the source of a lot of our woman on woman criticism and hate.
Well, I would even push back on that a little bit, and I'd go underneath that. And the underneath that is, as women, thinking that we are entitled to what we want. I think the bigger issue, as I talk to women, is sort of a sheepishness. And shame is not the right word, but a sheepishness about stating their wants and thinking that they're allowed to fulfill them.
100%. And then I think it becomes, how dare she? I would never allow myself to do the same.
Right, right. Because of course, she's going to expose herself to criticism, envy, you know, just expose herself, period.
Yeah.
Okay, exactly. So here's my last question for you. I mean, we could go on for a long time, but let's recognize that people have only a certain amount of time. So what role should sins have in our life? You know, part of your book is to release oneself from the constraint of how we have culturally interpreted these sins. But should there be a moral compass? Is there a way to internalize these sins in a way that's healthy? Or should we, should it just be, you know, you do you?
Yeah, no, that's a fantastic question. And I could have written a stunty, like, my year of being lustful and gluttonous and greedy. And that's not the point. The book is about balance and reconciliation, and that these sins are really beautiful, actually neutral guideposts. They're sort of GPS points bringing us back to ourselves, and they must be reconciled. They can't just be suppressed, denied. We can't say, like, I don't have any sexual appetite. I don't have any hunger. I don't have any anger, right? It is, instead, they are sort of the mechanism by which we really fully experience ourselves, the good and the bad, the light and the shadow, however you want to say it. We are all of these things. We have all of this in us. And to pretend for women to live their lives denying all of these very human impulses and urges and appetites, and to profess that those are bad, is living really at half mast. It's just not being who we are, which is human and divine.
Well, that is the note on which I'd like us to end. Human and divine. It doesn't get much better than that. Elise. We've been talking with Elise Lunin, the author of On Our Best Behavior, The Seven Deadly Sins and the Price Women Pay to Be Good. And Elise, thank you for, with this book, encouraging women to begin having this conversation with each other, with themselves, and, you know, to release themselves, to realize their potential, because that's what we hope for men and women.
Yeah.
For everybody to be able to realize their own unique full potential. So thank you for getting the conversation started.
Thank you for having me. This was such a pleasure.
Just the Right Book is not just a podcast. JustTheRightBook.com is a highly personalized book subscription service. It's good for readers of all ages. We have decades and decades of bookselling experience at RJ Julia's, and they're the ones who are selecting these books. here's what happens. We get tons and tons of letters. We've been around for over 10 years, and the letters always are a version of this. I can't believe you picked out this book. I would have never picked it out. And guess what? It was just the right book. So visit justtherightbook.com for details and begin your subscription today. Of course, we have a promo code for you. So if you go to justtherightbook.com, use the promo code podcast, and you will get 15% off on your subscription at justtherightbook.com. You are listening to Just the Right Book with Roxanne Cody, brought to you by LitHub Radio. The show is produced by Roxanne Cody, Michael Selleck, and LitHub Radio. Our editor is Gino Cardone at Pleasant Podcast. The original theme music is by Kurt Feldman. You can subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I am Roxanne Cody. Thank you so much for listening. And if you have any comments, observations, suggestions, we'd love to hear from you. You can email me at justtherightbook@rjjulia.com.